I'm Terrence McNally, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. The Dow hit 13,000 this week. One U.S. company, Apple, is now valued at over $500 billion. Yet manufacturing growth slowed, construction spending slipped, consumer spending remains weak. What accounts for this disparity? How important is it? What can be done about it? And how is all this going to play out in this year's elections? Our first guest is Daniel Gross, economics editor at Yahoo Finance. He has a forthcoming book, Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline. Welcome to The Point, Daniel Gross.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Okay. Mixed news yesterday, mixed news lately. The big thing that jumps out at me is the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. What accounts for that?
I would say there were two big things. One is that Main Street, especially when you're talking about housing and jobs, this is a local U.S. national economy problem. We had a very deep recession, and you know we are coming back from it, but many instances have not reached the prior peak. By contrast, the stock market, which is a corporate phenomenon, is also an international one. One of the reasons Apple is doing so well is because it is selling like hotcakes in China and everywhere around the world. The biggest countries, the biggest companies in the indexes like the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Intels, the McDonald's, the Cokes and Pepsis, Microsoft, they are all getting 65, 70, 80% of their revenues outside the U.S. And so one of the features of the last few years has been that the U.S. consumer first went into hibernation and then has been coming back sluggishly, but that consumer demand around the world in Brazil and India and China has been booming. And if you are a company that can take part in that, why, you're doing quite well. And so that explains, I think, a large degree of why stocks are doing so well. The typical company in the S&P 500, that's a pretty broad index, it gets more than about half of its revenues outside the U.S., and of course, it's getting most of its growth outside the U.S.
And what about the fact that that money that's being made by those companies and being made on Wall Street may not be trickling down to workers, middle class families, and so on?
Well, we're not seeing it in, you know, we have not seen strong wage growth in the U.S. because a lot of companies are hiring overseas. We have a lot of slack in our economy. One of the reasons we continue to have very high deficits is that companies which are earning so much money overseas are not, you know, they're keeping that money offshore. They're not bringing it home, repatriating it, which would then trigger tax payments. So that is an ongoing issue. And I think the sort of second big issue between Wall Street and Main Street, Wall Street, it's famously said that stocks are a futures market. People are buying based on returns they think they will get in the future. And companies, I think, are generally very optimistic about their ability to grow and continue to increase profits. The pain we're seeing in the U.S. of jobs and in particular housing, that is kind of a relic of things that happened in the past. We are still feeling the effects of the housing boom and the massive misallocation of capital where so many people were employed in construction and things relating to housing that have not been able to find, you know, other things to do, that household wealth continues to suffer because people are underwater on their mortgages, and the financial system continues to suffer because of this whole foreclosure mess. So those things, which I think are acting as dampeners to the economy, are basically not relics, but remnants of what happened in 04, 05, 06, 07. So you have a past market, which is the U.S. consumer, our housing market, the job situation, and the futures market, which is people investing in stocks in expectation of future growth and revenues. And again, a disconnect there. We had a very bad past. The years 05 through 08 and 09 were horrific. The last couple of years for companies have been pretty good, and I think, you know, broadly speaking, there is this sense that companies will and can do well in the global environment.
Mm. Yeah, obviously, your book, your upcoming book, says that, right? The American economy is better, stronger, faster, and you say there is a myth of American economic decline. How long is this lag going to last, in your view? This lag before it hits Main Street?
Well, look, it is starting Main Street is starting to improve, and I think if you look at the data, the private sector has added more than 3 million jobs since 2010. There are 2 million more people today that have payroll jobs than had them a year ago. That's a piece of improvement that can't be denied. We are still below the peak of 07 when it comes to employment. Industrial production has been growing strongly. Construction is starting to come back. Virtually every economic metric you look at is moving in the right direction. They have not regained the peaks that they were at in 2006 and 2007, but a lot of that was held aloft by a bubble. It's like saying, you know, the NASDAQ, which is the tech stock market, is at about 3,000. It was at 5,000 in 1999. And, you know, we had this crazy tech stock bubble that crashed. But there's still been a lot of positive developments in the economy without that particular metric regaining its pre-bubble peak. And I think we go through periods in this. When the stock market crashed in 1929, it took 25 years for the Dow Jones to get back to that 1929 peak. But in those 25 years, we had a lot of economic growth, a huge number of economic developments, innovation, technology, et cetera. The problem, I think, this time around was that the bubble was in housing, which is an asset that many, many, many people have that is often encumbered by debt that is hard to get out of. And so, you know, we're 5 or 6 years after the peak of housing, and it's still going down. And it could be another generation before housing gets back to where it was. But in the meantime, there are other things and other sectors that have been driving growth.
Okay, Daniel Gross is going to stay with us. And now let me bring into the conversation Robert Frank, professor of economics at Cornell, author of many books. The latest is The Darwin Economy, Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good. He also co-authored with Ben Bernanke a study text, Principles of Microeconomics. Welcome to The Point, Robert Frank.
Nice to be back with you, Terry.
Okay. My first question is really the same one I asked Daniel Gross, which is, what accounts for the disconnect? And then if you want to carry it into, you know, how important is that disconnect to this nation?
Yeah, I think Dan hit on a lot of great points. Most of them had to do with what's happened since the financial crisis began in 2008 and the aftermath of that event. I think there are some interesting trends that are affecting us that began long before that as well. I've been tracking for a long time movements in the growth of income at different points along the income distribution, and there I think we have an ongoing phenomenon that's going to continue to shape what goes on in the economy, and it's that the wages at the bottom of the ladder have been actually falling in inflation-adjusted terms, largely stagnant throughout most of the rest of the distribution, with significant growth really confined only to a small slice at the top. And the more finely you cut up that slice at the top, the bigger the gains get. And so when you're up into the top 1%, the top 0.1%, the top 0.01%, you see more and more spectacular income growth. And I think the changes in purchasing patterns that we've seen have been driven to a large extent by where the income's going.
Mm-hmm. So thus the movement this year of 99%, 1%. Do you anticipate a closing of this differential between the rich and the middle class if we proceed as we are, or is it going to call for some sort of innovative approach?
Yeah, I think if we look at where pre-tax incomes are going to go, they're largely driven by market forces. And as Dan pointed out, you were a player at one time. If you were the best producer in your local area, then the markets expanded. You had to be the best in your region, then statewide, and then countrywide. Now really, to be a player, you have to be the best at what you do virtually all around the globe. And I think that simple fact, and the fact that the best players can export the value of what they do virtually anywhere in the globe for almost nothing in shipping costs and other barriers, means that the real income gains are going to continue being driven into the pockets of the top performers in the economy. So in pre-tax terms, no, I don't think we'll see any narrowing of the gap between rich and poor. Other countries have reacted quite differently than the U.S. has. However, they've tried to lean into that economic wind. They've used the tax system and public expenditures to try to cushion the economic situation of people further down the ladder. Here, we've oddly done just the opposite. We've actually been cutting taxes for people at the top of the income distribution, the very same ones who've been getting most of the gains. And now we're hearing, at least on the Republican side, proposals to slash the meager social safety net that we have in this country, the weakest one by far of any industrial country. There are proposals to cut it further. So I think if we really want to see a smoothing of economic outcomes in the country, the people at the top have been getting really all the gains. We're going to have to look to the tax and expenditure system to see some progress there.
Yeah, and what would you recommend? In other words, I think so often people just point to income tax, and I think when you're talking about income tax, capital gains, payroll tax, and so on. What would you recommend to accelerate this bringing the middle class back?
You know, the simplest step would be to make the income tax system more progressive. It used to be more progressive. The top tax rates could kick in later in the income distribution. In the 1950s, the top tax rate was much higher than it is now, and it didn't kick in until you were up over $500,000 a year in income in those dollars, which was really a lot of money at the time. I've always recommended a different approach, which is to scrap the income tax entirely. In its place, adopt a much more steeply progressive tax on the total amount the family spends each year. So what you would do, Terrence, you'd report your income to the IRS the same as you do now. Then you'd report how much you'd save during the year. People know how to do that already from their experience with 401k plans and IRAs and the like. And then it's the difference between those two numbers, your income minus your savings, that's how much you consumed during the year. That amount minus a big standard deduction, let's say $30,000 for a family of four, is the taxable consumption for the year. The rates would start out very low. You'd pay less than under the current income tax for most people in the lower and middle reaches of the consumption distribution. But then once you got into truly high levels of consumption, the rates would soar much higher than under the current income tax. And switching the tax structure in that way would generate multiple benefits over what we have now. It would make life easier for people up and down the ladder, but it would also be a boon to people at the top of the income ladder.
You're going to stay with us a little bit, Robert?
I'll hang on.
Okay, let me bring into the conversation Thomas Donlan, editorial page editor for Barron's National Business and Financial Weekly, a publication of Dow Jones, and the author of World of Wealth, How Capitalism Turns Profit into Progress. Welcome to the Point, Thomas Donlan.
Hi, Terrence.
Hi. A lot has gone on in the first few minutes, but I do want to return to the first question with you again, Thomas. How do you explain the disconnect, and how much does it matter?
Well, I agreed with everything that Daniel Gross said, and I agreed with a lot that Professor Frank said, too. But I would add that, I would more emphasize that stock markets anticipate that it is it's a mechanism by which people try to profit by predicting the future, and it's not always right. There's an old saying that the stock market predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. It tends also to predict 9 of the last 5 booms. What Keynes called animal spirits rules the stock market just as much or more than any other sector of business. But I think that, in addition to that, we ought to focus more intensively on the fact that stock market's going up because companies are profitable, not just because they're doing such a great job of marketing and producing overseas, but also because wherever they're doing it with very high productivity. The successful companies that are now making lots and lots of money are doing so in part because they figured out how to run, in case of manufacturing, how to run their production lines with fewer workers. They also have figured out how to use computers even more to speed the development of new products, to make those new products more efficient. There's just been a lot of productivity, and that means that the most labor-intensive companies, which were the hardest hit in the late recession, like construction, also happen to be companies and industries where they can't really tap into productivity very much. And the number, you can give a carpenter a nail gun instead of a hammer, but you can't get rid of the need to have him hammer in, dozens and dozens of nails for every 4x8 piece of plywood.
Let me bring into the conversation now Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a left-of-center economic research organization based in Washington, author of many books. His latest is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Dean Baker, welcome to The Point.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay. You've heard a bit, I know, of what's preceded you. My question, I will give you the same first question I gave all of them, which is how do you account for the disconnect between stock market profits and Main Street income and spending?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, one of the points Thomas had made, that the stock market often gets it wrong. I mean, so sometimes you just get a jump up, irrational exuberance, in the case of the late 90s. And I don't mean to say that's what's going on today, but it could be, so that could be part of the story. But the other part is simply we're asking two different questions. In principle, what the stock market's supposed to be measuring is future profits of U.S. corporations. And those might be very high precisely because people are hurting. So, Thomas is talking about productivity growth. We've had good productivity growth last few years, last 15 years, in fact. It's not new at this point. And if you're seeing good productivity growth and it's not going to wages, well, then it ends up in profits. So for the exact same reason that most people are hurting, of course, most people don't have much stock, even in 401ks. Most people have little or none. Then what that means is, stock market can go up because people are hurting. They're not getting their share of productivity growth and wage growth.
Okay, let me ask on one thing you just put in there as a parenthetical, that not many people have much money in the stock market. We have heard over the last, maybe decade or so, that the stock market has become more democratic, more small d democratic, more people in it. You're saying, but the amount that most have in it is a drop in the bucket?
Exactly. I mean, there's certainly wider ownership today than, say, if you go back to 1980. But, looking at the 2007, the Fed does a survey of consumer finance every three years. The most recent survey, just over 50% held any stock at all. This is including through mutual funds that are held in retirement accounts. And the median holding was just $35,000. So most people, you could say three-quarters of the population, has less than $35,000 in the stock market. And, of course, since the market's gone down some since then, it'd probably be, around 30 or thereabouts. So most people, if the stock market goes up 10 or 15%, they're happy to hear that, I'm sure. But, it's not going to make much difference to them.
Okay, and we heard a lot about productivity gains. When productivity is making gains as it has been repeatedly and consistently, does that mean that there are some people who are not going to find a place back in this economy?
Well, it can. I mean, it really shouldn't. I mean, this story, sometimes people say, well, it's really bad. We have productivity growth. That's going to cost jobs. Well, it may be the case, but in principle, we know how to create jobs. We know how to create demand. But in this economy, of course, we have, some on the order of 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, out of the workforce altogether because there's not enough demand in the economy. I mean, that's really an indictment of very bad economic policy. That should not be the case, but that's where we are today.
Okay. Thanks, Dean Baker. Let me go back to Tom Donilon. Should more people be investing in the stock market, or given what Dean Baker just said, should more people be investing more in the stock market? Is that the way for more people to build wealth?
Well, it is a way for people to build wealth. But there are so many points that need to be defined. You just can't give that a yes or no. Are we talking about people who are the classic middle class plungers who take the money that they would have wasted in Las Vegas or in a casino and put it in the casino called the stock market? Generally speaking, such people don't do any better in one as in the other. They buy, in the case of the stock market, they buy at peaks, or at least they buy they almost never buy when it's cheap. They often sell when it's very cheap because they think it'll never go up again. These are the common mistakes that that people make. Now, Dean pointed out correctly that very few people have much in their 401ks. That's a problem that wasn't expected when the 401k was invented back in the 1970s. It was expected that people would respond to the tax shelters and the incentives for employers to match their savings contributions, and expected by many people, including me. And I'm just appalled at how wrong that's turned out to be. People don't put enough money away for savings into any mechanism, whether it be the stock market or a bank savings account. But by and large, if they approach it correctly, the stock market is the place that a person under 60 years old should have most of their savings, and they should all have a lot more savings than they do,
yeah,
including me.
Does that put you in that age group?
No, I'm actually beyond that age group, but that's okay.
Yeah. So, Tom, what is the solution to the differential between the wealthy and the middle class? Because I think what you just said about the stock market is you better be wise before you be eager.
Yeah, to some extent. And I don't think there is the stock market, nor anything else that I can think of, would solve the disparity between the wealthy and the middle class, because the wealthy got that way by and large from being a combination of highly productive, highly lucky, or highly fortunate in their choice of parents, of which the really important one is being highly productive. Much of the growth that we've enjoyed in the past 30 years has come from the fact that investors have made all these companies more productive. Using money to create new wealth is the key, not who's got the money today.
Mm-hmm. Dean Baker, what do you think about how the wealthy got that way?
Well, I think it's a very mixed bag. I mean, certainly you have many who are very productive, very talented, but I say, and this is, the point of my book, that we've rigged the deck, that we have rules that have tilted the distribution of income upward over the last three decades. It hasn't been an accident. It's a wide variety of areas. One of the obvious ones, finance. I'm mentioning this because it's been in the news, hard to miss. You have huge fortunes being made in finance where you have people working at too big to fail institutions, essentially operating with government subsidies, because everyone knows, or at least they believe, Goldman Sachs is not going to go out of business. So in effect, Goldman Sachs is authorized to gamble at our risk, where they keep the winnings, they pocket the winnings, and if they lose, there's a government bailout waiting for them. But that's across the board, patents, drug patents, horrible abuse, in that system. And people don't realize how much money's at stake there. We spend around $300 billion a year on prescription drugs, where if they were sold in a free market, they'd cost us around $30 billion. So that gap, that $270 billion a year, is five times as much as what is at stake in the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%, the tax cuts that, President Obama and the Republicans in Congress are debating. Five times as much as at stake in patent protection for prescription drugs. Needless to say, the income from that is going to Pfizer, going to Merck, some no doubt very talented scientists there, but that's one of the things that redistributes income upward. So I point to a number of things like that have had the effect of redistributing income upward over the last three decades. That's what I'd like to change. I don't think, I'm all for having somewhat higher tax rates. I think I'm with Robert Frank on that. Whether we pick the exact same number, I can't say. But I think the bigger thing is the before-tax income distribution, and that has been rigged. I think it's important for people to understand it didn't just happen that you had these people get incredibly wealthy. They rigged the deck.
Okay. One thing I want to ask, I'll ask you, Dean Baker, quickly, then I want to go to Daniel Gross and Tom Donlan on this. What about a speculation tax, which everyone talks about it every now and then? Is that something that would actually hurt the stock market sufficiently that it wouldn't be worth what it would gain? Let me start with you, Dean, then Tom, and then let's go to Daniel.
Well, I'm a huge fan of this. The idea is that you'd have a small tax. It could be a tenth of a percentage point. The UK has it a half a percentage point on each trade. For normal investors, it'd be almost invisible. It would hit people who are buying and selling by the day, or these days sometimes by the minute. And it could raise an awful lot of money. The UK just taxes stock trades. They don't tax derivative instruments, you know, options, futures, credit, just stock trades. And they raise between 2 and 3 tenths of a percentage point a year. That'd be 30 to 40 percentage points of GDP. That'd be between 30 and $40 billion a year in the United States. That's, I think, real money by both most people's measure. And, you know, London Stock Exchange is still one of the largest exchanges in the world, so it hasn't shut it down.
Okay, Tom?
Well, I don't disagree that that the British transactions tax is not really a tax on speculation, except indirectly, because the more trades you make, the higher you're going to pay a tax. I don't have any problem with it in theory. My major problems with it are: can I trust my government to use that money wisely? It's not the same thing to simply give the government money as it is to give people money which they can then invest or consume on their own. So the question of a transactions tax or a tax on speculation is problematic. What does it say that you want more people trading in the stock market? You know, this is some people. This is where wealth comes from, and definitely it moves money around in the economy. If I lose $10,000 speculating in some fly by night company, that money doesn't disappear. It goes to the person that sold me the stock. And it may be in smarter, better, wiser hands if I lose it and somebody else gains it.
I'll ask you one more question, Tom, and then I'm going to ask both these questions, that one and one and this next one, to Daniel Gross. Apple, I talked about a couple of times, now valued at $500 billion, and sitting on, I think, $90 billion. Should Apple reinvest its money or pay dividends? Should it be doing something with that money?
Well, first off, that's none of my business, except insofar as I might have Apple shares tucked away somewhere. But since I don't directly, I would say it's really not any of my business what Apple does. That said, a lot of investors in Apple would like them to pay a dividend or do a stock buyback that would make the stock go up even more, or they might just have a price cut and take less profit, which I think is the least probable of all. But you can't tell a company that it has to pay out a certain amount in dividends, because some companies shouldn't pay any dividends. And the other alternative is that Apple might choose to invest in the shares of other companies, or it might buy whole companies that it thinks are strategic to its future growth. Both Google and Intel do that to a great degree.
Okay,
there are plenty of incentives for Apple to use its money wisely already. We don't have to tell it what to do.
Dan Gross, first of all, the speculation tax, then Apple's strategy.
Well, you know, if you're talking about taxing the type of speculation that me and Tom and Dean and Professor Frank do, political and economic speculation, we should definitely not tax that. We are underpaid, and any tax on our personal intellectual speculation would be bad. But a tax on trades and financial transactions, I think, makes a lot more sense. And I don't think you should call it a tax on speculation. I think you should call it a tax on trades, just like we have tolls for going on highways and user fees every time someone buys an airline ticket. It makes sense to tax that. And one of the reasons, you know, Tom spoke before about if we tax speculation, that would push people out of the markets. The problem in the markets these days aren't the people. The problem in the markets are the machines.
Exactly.
There's all this algorithmic trading. These people who have set up these systems that are executing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of trades every second that are designed to capture, you know, one-tenth of a cent move or a penny move. And those people who run those will tell you, oh, we're supplying liquidity, we're making the markets move more smoothly. No, that's what helped cause the flash crash when the stock market fell 1,000 points, you know, in a matter of a few minutes. That's what causes a lot of this volatility that we're seeing, which in fact evidence seems to be showing is pushing individual investors out of the market because they feel like, you know, they're these little fish jumping in where these electronic sharks are running around. If we were to put a tax on some of those on transactions generally, it would make a lot of that activity either less profitable or maybe perhaps not profitable at all. And I think that would be, you know, the removal of some of this high frequency trading would actually be a net positive for the economy as a whole. So I think, in addition, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is charged with monitoring fairness in the markets and policing them, is in a situation where it gets all its money from Congress. So people, the securities industry lobbies Congress not to give money to the SEC so they can't do their job properly. It would be great if some percentage of this transaction tax would go to fund the SEC so they wouldn't be have to go sort of kowtowing to the relevant congressional committee for their budget, and they might, you know, that might enable them to do their job a little more effectively than they have done in the last 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And that speaks a little bit to what Tom was saying about, who knows what the government will do with it. You're saying you could actually earmark it and have it do some.
You could earmark a chunk for deficit reduction, and you could earmark a chunk for the SEC. And then you wouldn't have to worry about somebody spending it on a bridge to nowhere.
Very good. Your thoughts about Apple?
Well, I sure wish I had bought it several years ago when it was trading at $8 a share. You know, one of the ironies and one of the issues in our economy is the reluctance of the corporate world to share. We've seen, not in Apple's case, but certainly in the corporate world in general, a reluctance to share with its employees. You know, one of the reasons productivity has been so high is that management has been beating the living daylights out of labor, which is to say, one of the ways you get productivity is by investing in new machines, and another way you get productivity is by saying, hey, you used to make $20 an hour, now you're going to do that job for 15, or now you're going to work a couple extra hours. Wages have not been rising even as corporate profits have been bouncing back really rapidly. So companies are generally reluctant to share their profits with their employers. They are reluctant to share their profits with the government because they are trying to evade taxes and keep money offshore. And there has been something of reluctance to share it with shareholders. You know, dividends, when the economy went bad in 2007, 2008, if you're a company, one of the first things you might do to conserve cash and ensure that you can survive is reduce your dividend or eliminate it. That's what Ford did, for example. And I think companies have generally been a little slow to reinstate their dividends, to increase them, to put them in the first place, because they're still kind of shell-shocked from that period in 07, 08, where, you know, you literally didn't have enough money to keep the doors open, where you couldn't access credit. So now they're erring on the side of holding more cash than they need. And it's not just Apple. It's Google. It's industrial companies. It's service companies. It's Microsoft. They have more cash than they know what to do with. They don't have, you know, they don't want to run around and buy a lot of companies. They don't want to open a lot of new factories. They're not finding great investment opportunities. And yet they were reluctant to just say, you know what, let's pay out a higher percentage. So I think it's sort of an extreme version of something we're seeing throughout the economy.
Okay, last word from Dean Baker. Any thoughts about Apple?
Well, I'd love to see them give some to their employees, particularly in the developing world. The New York Times had a very good piece on Foxconn, which is their major producer of their products in China. And, you know, pretty awful conditions there. And, you know, if you were to raise the cost to Apple of producing an iPhone or iPod by $3 or $4, let it come out of their profit margin, they still would be, you know, tremendously profitable. That can make a huge difference in the living standards of the workers in China. So, you know, that's what I would focus on. In terms of, you know, some of the points Tom was making, yeah, I don't know whether they have good investment opportunities. It is striking, certainly, that they're sitting on so much money and don't seem to know what to do with it. So I don't know whether there are good investment opportunities they're not pursuing, whether they, you know, are looking to buy up other companies. Maybe we're going to reach tomorrow. They have some big buyout planned. But, you know, I'd expect them to do something with that money. Otherwise, you know, from their vantage point, it's just a waste.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm going to thank all of you. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Daniel Gross, economics editor at Yahoo Finance, and Tom Donlan, editorial page editor for Barron's National Business and Financial Weekly, and Robert Frank, who was with us earlier, professor of economics at Cornell.